All right, I do, however, have a syllabus for you. And the picture is a detail from one of the paintings of Ilya Repin, who is one of the few distinguished Russian painters, 19th century painter who painted many of the crucial scenes of Russian history, all of which had become mythic by his time. But this seemed to me to be especially suited to our class, with all the drama implied between the church and the individual, the tradition and the free thinker, all of which sets the background for the great novels that we'll be reading. So you should find our information here, both me and Dr. Dupree, where we can be reached. A brief statement of the rationale, of course. The explosion of the novel in 19th century Russia is a remarkable phenomenon in literary study. As Russia became westernized and its intellectual leaders turned away from ancient cultural and religious roots, its writers began to assimilate the European literary tradition and, paradoxically, to grow more conscious of their own native heritage. The combination produced a body of novels that some consider unmatched for complexity, profundity, and power. These novels, according to George Steiner, are religious in the way the Iliad and the Divine Comedy are religious, probing the metaphysical basis of existence and the relation of the human to the divine order. So that conflict of tradition and modernity, I do believe, is a very, very brief way of saying the theory of the novel. It's a very, very brief way of saying that that is what makes the novel and makes the novel a potentially great form of poetry. Because it cannot arise in a culture that's all tradition. The novel streamlines, the novel individualizes, it turns into that stream of prose. The novel institutionalizes or sanctifies a point of view and makes that one point of view a window on the whole world. At the same time, in a world that's become completely modernized, there's so little to find truly remarkable. That conflict is necessary because the novel is about discovering in the prosaic and mundane world the depths of existence that have gone into hiding in a modernized world. So, and that conflict becomes especially visible when a traditional society is set upon by the new canons of Western modernity. Less dramatic is the case in the core of Europe, where the novel, where the Western novel grew up, and it grew up organically. Although we have great instances of the novel in Europe and in England, it is nonetheless a place that understood it, that grew up the novel, grew the novel out of understanding itself, and so that sudden shock could never really happen. It was D.H. Lawrence who said in 1924 that European literature had exhausted itself and that only on the peripheries, the two peripheries, Russia and America, could truly great literature still be found. He wrote this in a little book called Studies in Classic American Literature. Now, Lawrence is always perverse in his views, but I think, and will sacrifice many an accuracy for a dramatic statement. But I think in this case, it's quite true. And I think also it begins to tell us something about the extreme opposition of Russian and American consciousness, because both have great novelists, both have cultures that were in a high state of development in the 19th century, and yet in many ways they couldn't be more opposite. And as Americans, if we don't have already cultural ties to Russia, we may find Russian culture and the Russian novel very, very strange. And yet I think it is crucial to our understanding. It's crucial to our understanding of Western civilization. So if we have too monotone a notion of what Western culture can be, then Well, we take part in turning it into marble, into something that can be, or plaster maybe might be the better term, something that can be shattered, brittle. We see its suppleness. We see its roundedness when we see the contrast that Russian culture offers to us. So I do believe it's an aspect of Western culture, and I'm going to try it at length today to trace its connection to the West. But it is that one of those cultures that the West has turned its back on, and that nonetheless has profound insights for all of us. And so I think this will provide a background to us for the Russian novel. Now, the text that we're going to read, we have listed here, we did look carefully to try and find the best translation, because we are unabashedly reading these in translation. Dead Souls is a particularly good example. This was just reissued by Yale University Press. It was the, by far, best translation, and then it went out of print. Bernard Gilbert Gurney, who was himself celebrated by many, a writer, and was himself in touch with the whole literary community. But this has just been reissued, so we're glad to have this this edition, which I think you'll just find a lot more enjoyable than some of the other more dominant, more, you know, volume-selling translations of Dead Souls. And the others, I just brought these first two because they're the easiest to carry. These are the shortest two novels. This is Fathers and Sons, and one of the Modern Library classics. And wherever possible, for the most part, well, maybe not wherever possible, but for many of these, we're relying on Constance Garnett, who was a friend of Joseph Conrad and an inexhaustible translator. And so we have the Garnett translation of Fathers and Sons, of Dostoevsky's novels. I think we're not doing that for the Devils, and not doing it for Anna Karenina, although she did translate those novels, didn't she? So just for a little variety, I wanted to try a little something else. But I think that those are some of the best translations available. So we've ordered those editions. It's certainly possible to follow along with another edition, but it's our recommendation to go with these. And especially in the case of those last two novels, because these are the Norton Critical Edition, and as you know, the Norton Critical Edition has those little added bonuses after the text, the various selected criticism, historical facts about the novel and the novelist and the times and so forth. All of those can be very valuable as we work toward the only real labor other than reading the books that you have to do in this class. We have cleared the decks on this class so that you're not going to be bothered by projects here and projects there, cutouts that you have to make in class with carefully blunted scissors or anything like that. You have one big paper to write, and it's going to be due toward the end of the semester. And other than that, it's basically read the novels and stand for quizzes that we're going to pose for you during the semester. So if you look on the second page, now this is a rough idea of how we think each week will go, but we will do a lot of lecturing, but we also want a discussion period each week, especially when we've had some materials for you to read. In this case, on Tuesday, we certainly will welcome your questions and answers, but I'm not going to force them out of you. This will all be lecture up to that point. Your first novel will be due on September 10th, and there will be a quiz on it on the 15th, so you really have until the 15th to finish it. But please don't get used to that leisurely a pace, because after Fathers and Sons, the novels get massive, and the quizzes follow quite hard and fast. The Idiots, the Devils, the Brothers Karamazov, and Anna Karenina, we've split up into halves or thirds so that you would read a section of it and have to take a quiz on that section each time. Some topics that we're going to be covered are listed here in the schedule of classes for today. For instance, the Enigma of Russia, Highlights of Russian History, the Russian Character, the Russian Myth, Westernization, icons, folktales, Pushkin, the Bronze Horseman. We can't possibly cover all these things today, but we will eventually. and possibly by the very next class. There's a little bit of a further description about the quizzes on page 3, about question and answer sessions or discussion sessions. We will try different formats for discussion, but I know you'll have, you know, many things that you want to say, remark, or ask, and I want to encourage participation in this class. The big paper, a brief description of it, is that it should develop an insight into Dostoevsky's vision as an artist and thinker, making use of his novels read in this class. So unabashedly, we are tilted toward Dostoevsky, and with 3 of his novels, and as well, an assumption that although not a requirement, that you've read Crime and Punishment. If you haven't, we'll do a little summarizing of it during the semester, so not to worry. But these 3 massive novels of Dostoevsky make him more or less the center of this course. And we're looking at a 10-page paper for undergraduates with some outside sources, 6 a minimum, and for graduates a 15-page paper with at least 12 sources. So the Norton Critical Edition will come in handy. Now about grading, I'm going to have to say, after I went to the trouble of getting this pretty syllabus printed up, I had second thoughts about the weighting of the grading, and so you might want to strike through those numbers. And also the idea of a mid-semester exam, I don't believe, unless Scott would like, that we need a mid-semester exam. So I'd like these different elements to be more balanced, and so let me get back to you about exact numbers, but I think basically the final exam is going to count for 1 unit, the paper is going to count for 1 unit, and then all the quizzes plus the participation in class are going to count for another unit. They'll all be equal in that regard, and I'll figure out the numbers for next time. But I think that's fair. I think the quizzes, in other words, are important. These are not throwaway quizzes. For the reason that there's very little else for you to do except write and talk. There will be 11 of them. 3 of them will be forgiven, whether you take them or not. And so those 8 quizzes will bear the brunt of your reading, and each week will be about 3% more or less of your grade. Now there's a note here about how to read a novel. I don't want to sound presumptuous here. I presume you can read a novel, but I want to encourage you, in case you're have formed other habits, to clear the decks once again and read fast. One should read rapidly, underlining important words, phrases, and whole passages as one goes, not stopping to analyze. So we're not reading Plato or Aristotle here, just out of reference to the previous class in this room. We're reading something that you need to immerse yourself in. Do not be a close reader as you go. Think about it. What is it that made these novels so beloved by, you know, thousands, millions of readers? It's the experience of it. You have to have the experience. And so, yes, keep a pencil in your hand, but only to make passing marks as you go, almost skid marks as you're going from page. If there's an important page, you know, make a decoration on it in some way or another and move on. It's a kiss and a promise, but you've got to get the experience of feeling the momentum of where the character is going, of where the action is going, immersing yourself in the depths of what the novelist is describing. I want you to have that experience. It cannot be a work of art without it. Often we don't comment on these things, but you can't look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling without emotions going through you on that. So the same has got to be true in a novel, and especially in these great Russian novels. So you have to read quickly and trust also that the meaning of it is going to come to you more fully later. The class certainly will contribute, class time will contribute toward that experience. But you do not arrive at a final meaning of the novel by reading it the first time or by reading it carefully. Even if you're reading it extremely carefully, the first time you can't do it. It gels in your mind. The thing about novels is that they are organic. So the experience of reading must become organic. And the experience of interpreting it has to become organic as well. It has to come upon you later. And for this, you have to, as I say, get away from your habits of close and careful and scholarly reading and read as a customer would read, as a reader. Reading, of course, it's often been said it's a lost art, and it's becoming more and more lost all the time. I agree, but I'm not going to make a big grumpy point about that. We're entering into something new and strange, but to even be able to interpret what we're entering into, we need to know the self-coherence of the old forms, and the novel has now become an old form that we need to know. Finally, a suggestion that don't skip class is basically what it's saying. If you have failed to read enough by the time a novel is due in class, nevertheless, come to class, skip the quiz if you want to keep your dignity, and make every effort to keep up with the current assignment, leaving any unfinished portion of the earlier novel to be completed later. It is crucial to keep up with the current assignment. Again, the assumption here is that the class has essential data for you. So we hope we can deliver on that. I think we can, and you should come and not feel humiliated that you didn't finish these enormous assignments that we're giving you. Any questions or comments about the course so far?
Yeah. So just to verify, you want us to have read the work before we start to discuss it?
Right. Now, you could there...
Not the whole work.
The whole work,
for the
not
first
necessarily.
Lecture.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why we put the quiz on in the second class there.
Okay.
Yeah. So you should be getting into it, but we're giving you a little bit of a reprieve. We can't leave Dead Souls, for instance, until you've taken a quiz on it. All right.
Okay.
So.
Another thing that drove me crazy in Richard Ford's Crime and Punishment was all the different names and all the different forms of everybody's name.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, in the edition we used, there was a list at the beginning?
Sometimes those editions have those. I don't think we do we? We can help. But
we can help, okay, good.
On a case-by-case
because
basis.
Russian and
on a novel-by-novel basis.
I might explain all of that next
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right, how these names are, what the patronymic is, how they're abbreviated, and so forth. All that could be very, very useful. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are the quizzes going to be like reading quizzes? Who did what and went where, when?
They are, and they're going to be with a particularly gimlet eye toward those kinds of details that you can't pick up by just reading Spark Notes and so forth.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Not just
so
meaningless
not
details, but
quizzes,
those important little details that are what novels are for. Yeah.
Things like what was the color of Sonia's shawl?
Green.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've already passed your crime and punishment exam. Too bad we're not doing it.
Other questions, comments? All right. So onward. Now, about this Russian enigma, I want to read this passage, really partly as an entry into this, and partly as a tribute to Louise Cowan, who brought this kind of theological depth to this course. This is from Jean Mouru. He was one of the writers in the Nouvelle Théologie movement that included, of course, Cardinal Ratzinger, among others. It's called The Meaning of Man. And it's a paragraph. I will read it to you. Man is a mystery, first, because he is a kind of limit or horizon between two worlds. He's immersed in the flesh, but constituted by the spirit, occupied with matter, but drawn toward God, growing in time, but already breathing the air of eternity. A being of nature and of the world, but also transcending the universe in virtue of his liberty and capacity for union with God. But if man is twofold, he is also one, susceptible of a full unity, and on the other hand, of a full disaggregation. He has to acquire a full significance of his own, and is tossed about meanwhile in all the whirlpools of the flesh and the world, We live out this drama. We suffer from it and bleed, but remain, for the most part, inwardly withdrawn from it because without acute sense of it. On the day when, by some flash of intellectual enlightenment or some effort at spiritual progress, we come to realize what we really are, we are seized with a kind of shiver. Man, then, is radically a mystery which refuses to be degraded into a problem. Man's nature is more opaque, more carnal, more terrible, and at the same time more luminous, more spiritual, and more joyous than we could ever have dared to think. Who would have known a Frenchman could come up with these thoughts? But it seems to me that kind of accent on the extreme polarity of our nature, right? That, and the fact that we are a mystery to ourselves is an unspoken insight that is at the beginning of all these Russian novels and comes out of the heart of Russian culture. The great Russian novels are great because they allow us entrance into this profound understanding of our own nature that Jean Mouraud describes. Access to the depths and heights of the human soul. Man is a mystery, not a problem. Now, this is a knowledge of ourselves that is not purely rational understanding of human nature, which always remains a somewhat alien kind of knowledge, as if from without. Nor, don't mistake me, it's not a romantic understanding, that particularly Western heresy that believes intense feeling can somehow overcome the gaps in our knowledge, that one's own subjectivity can show us the way. The Russian understanding of our existence arises out of 1,000 and more years of its experience as a people and the ideas and culture that have shaped it. It's that heritage we seek to understand through these great novels. And for these early classes, we want to focus especially on the background on which all the Russian novels draw. Now, why is Russia so hard for us to understand? There have been essays written on this particularity of Russia, on the strangeness of Russia. And one author that we will have recourse to from time to time as a commentator is Berdyaev, Nikolai. Is it Nikolai?
Mm-hmm.
Berdyaev. It's written number of books, a celebrated thinker. One of his essays is called The Soul of Russia. And in it he says the Russians are a people in the highest degree polarized. They are a conglomeration of contradictions, he says. They are neither purely European nor purely Asiatic. He goes on to say that two contradictory principles lie at the foundation of the structure of the Russian soul. The one, a natural Dionysian elemental paganism. The other, an ascetic monastic orthodoxy. And these extremes coexist in the Russian character. So there also, if we look at other opposites, we can swing between, on the one hand, despotism, on the other hand, anarchy. A Dionysiac earthiness and paganism, a monastic asceticism and orthodoxy. So the Russian character, Berdyaev says, is alternately arrogant and humble, hierarchical and collective, fanatical and tolerant, tyrannical and democratic, tragic and comic, earthy and spiritual, apocalyptic and humanitarian, submissive and rebellious. And the key terms we're going to be looking at today are Holy Russia, the idea of Holy Russia, of Mother Earth, the Tsar as father, and the people as family. Now, there were five periods that we can roughly divide Russian history into, beginning, though, with a, I guess, a zero point of pagan, of Russian paganism, about which there is no written history. And we only really gather it from cultural practices that survive, or that survived, and then were written about later, actual archaeology. So much is speculative about the pagan roots of Russia, but it's undeniable that its roots are pagan. And there's a great deal that's been written about that mythology of ancient Russia. The first historical period would be that of Kiev. This was broken up by the Mongol invasion, and so we would call this Russia under the Tartar yoke. Tartar or Tatar. So the Tartars were first subjugated by the Mongolians, and then they became their operatives, I guess you could say. So for the Russians, it was almost simultaneous, a synonym to say Tartar or Mongol. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. The rise of Moscow, both as resistance to the Mongols and as the new flowering of Russian civilization. Fourth, the Russia of Peter the Great. Which is 18th and 19th centuries. And then fifth, Soviet Russia. And we're existing now in a sixth era, which I'm not really sure what character it has yet. But probably a hasty essay written for, I don't remember whether it was Harper's or The Atlantic, in the 1990s, saying that Russia is over. Russia is finished. It was just flat wrong. They're going to make some trouble no matter what. We can count on that. And it will make life more interesting for everyone. Now, the uniqueness of Russia. So Dostoevsky wrote, if there is a country in the world that seems destined to remain unexplored and unknown by any other nation, either nearby or far away, that country is certainly Russia, at least as far as her Western neighbors are concerned. Not even China or Japan could ever hide from the curiosity of Europe as successfully as Russia has been doing in the past and in the present, and will probably continue to do so even in the distant future. But Dostoevsky was equally persuaded of an opposite truth. If Europe could not understand Russia, Russia could quite well understand Europe. So it's the outsiderliness of Russia that matters in this score. Its ability then to judge other cultures because of its removal from them. When Dostoevsky gave his famous memorial address to Pushkin, his praise was based on the fact that Pushkin was a universal writer. That he understood all men, and Dostoevsky considered this to be a particularly Russian trait. Now, about Russian myth, we want to go into a few points here. Authorities are divided with regard to the precise configuration of the ancient Russian mythology. The divinity of the cosmos, however, should be stressed. The divinity of the cosmos. And it found expression primarily through symbolisms that venerated the sun, S-U-N, sun and fire, and clan, and Mother Earth. And you'll have different historians and interpreters that believe one of these was the dominant figure. Now, a particularly useful author for me is G.P. Fedotov, who wrote a book called The Russian Religious Mind, and claims that the worship of the sun is secondary, and the core of Russian religion was the worship of Mother Earth. Interestingly, Vladimir I, who was the prince who later adopted Christianity, 8 years before he adopted Christianity for the realm, established a pantheon of cosmic divinities as definitive in Kiev and Novgorod, the two great cities in the 10th century. And he vigorously fostered revival of their worship by setting up temples and idols and reinstituting the offering of regular human sacrifice. Only 8 years later, he accepted Christianity. The year is 988. And that did a complete turnabout, abolished pagan worship, demolished every idol, and had the people more or less forcibly Christianized.
Would you like me to do that?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Now we have a few highlights of Russian history. This was once a one-page handout, and it's grown over the years. Now the highlights have highlights. So, the cosmic religiousness and mythology of the ancient Slavs remained vital influences for the Russian novel. And they conditioned Orthodox Christianity as well in Russia and persisted in a wide variety of transmutations in the bosom of the official church. They maintained uninterrupted continuity of existence in the consciousness, cults, and games of the peasantry. And they supplied a matrix for the dominant political symbolism of ancient Russia, the myth of the saintly prince, as this emerged into the figure of the pious Tsar. All these are figures that we'll see transmuted in the novels that we're going to read as well. But they won't appear as part of a coherent matrix. They'll appear as shards, as sudden appearances. And it will help, I think, so much to understand this background out of which they come. The notion of the eschatology of Moscow as the Third Rome. All of which had a definite time and purpose. The myth of Holy Russia, combining the holiness of land and people. So in other words, we have a notion of earth as holy, of Russian earth as holy, and then of the people as holy. And these are combined in the notion of Holy Russia. Clan in Russian is rod. This three-letter word will be the first Russian term for your glossary. All right. In Old Russian, this meant progenitor or procreator. And so the idea of the sacredness of the clan is tied to the notion of the father as well. There was a festival called the Radunitsa, a spring feast of the dead, or a funeral banquet. And note the propensity of our Russian novelists to have funeral banquets as scenes for important events in their novels, in which the veneration of ancestors occurs at the time of Easter week, symbolically in the churches and more passionately in churchyards and on the graves, where wine plays a great part. And it sometimes ends, one scholar tells us, in real orgies. So the impact of the rod or clan cult was such that it shaped all social life in Russia, extending to Russia the form of family life. So that sense of analogous, of the analogical notion of a world was rich in ancient Russia as it is in all traditional societies. And as we have a Russia that's a great family, the Tsar or whoever the leader is considered the great father of them all. All social relations could be reduced to or analogous to family relations, yes.
So rod as the clan cult in Russia does not just apply to ancient Russia, but also to more modern Russia.
Right, it's certainly, rod is a word in modern Russian.
It means clan cult?
Clan, basically, clan structure. But the word for city in Russian, gorod, mm-hmm. has the word rod in it, so a city is an extended clan, you see.
Okay.
Gorod.
kinds of oppositions that we find in Western social structure are simply less prominent in the Russian past, in the Russian tradition. The collective consciousness of the mir, or Russian village community, was one aspect of the veneration of parents, characteristic of the cult of Rod. Because of this consciousness, the experience of personality emerged only gradually and foggily, as so much weight was developed on seeing oneself as part of a whole tradition, as united with the dead and the generations of ancestors. There is also then linked to that the veneration of Mother Earth, as the parent from whom all come and to whom all return. The old Russian image of Mother Moist Earth, Mati Sira Zemlya, can be identified with the only female deity of Prince Vladimir's pantheon, Mokash, moisture in old Russian. So Moist Mother Earth, Mother Moist Earth, as the successor of the great goddess of the Scythians. So it relates to all those great goddess figures we find in mythology, but it connected specifically to the earth. The Russians venerated no virgin goddess, and womanly purity and beauty formed but a negligible part in their representation of sacred womanhood. Mother Earth has neither shape nor face. Her beauty is that of the embracing and developing sensuous nature with which man feels himself involved and permeated. So this is a truly passionately felt affection that peasants have for the earth, for Mother Earth. They use the term even today. These emphases then, not surprisingly, were absorbed into Mariology once Russia became Christian, and the Mother of God aspect of Mary was stressed over all others, the Theotokos, right, the God-bearer, translated literally as Bogoroditsa in Russian. Rather than an abstract and spiritual experience, there's palpable emotional power here. The accent lies on Tokos, the parent, the birth giver, the mother. The Russian Mary is not only the mother of God, but the universal mother, the mother of all mankind. So, stronger, if anything, presence of Mary in Russian Christianity. Okay. Now, so those are, I think, some brief aspects of the myth that give us an idea of the temporal depth, which some of these, all figures of attachment, of affection, and of a kind of almost destructuring attachment, right? So that you're one with the people, you're one with the earth, we're all the same, children under the mother, and so forth. That hierarchical and differentiating structure that marks so much of Western consciousness is opposed by this all-inclusive and all-embracing gesture. It's a distinction that we use with a little bit of caution, but we can, again, when I bring in a French theorist, but Gilles Deleuze made an important distinction between tree and rhizome. Because the tree structure in nature, as in society, is hierarchical and differentiated. And the rhizome is something that spreads out, a network, grows from the middle, and rather than develop structure, it develops presence. And always has every element in contact with every other. And so that sort of rhizomatic structure or structurelessness characterizes Russian belief in so many things, I think. In fact, Russian Christianity takes on that aspect as well. I think if we read Deleuze right, he said we really can't account for nature without both kinds of things. Right? Not that one is better than the other, but that there are those two aspects. Now, The earliest known history of Russia begins in the 9th century. So they are invaded by Viking warriors, and the Vikings really established their first permanent settlement, Novgorod. I guess you can follow along in your highlights a little bit. And the reign of the Vikings continued to Kiev, which then became the center of a trade route between Scandinavia and Constantinople, and then began to become the major city of that time. It was there that Prince Vladimir lived, and we have the story of his conversion to Christianity, in which he had sent emissaries out to the representatives of different major religions, Roman Catholicism, Greek Orthodoxy, Judaism, and Islam. And it's said, according to the chronicle, the primary chronicle of that time, that Vladimir rejected Muhammad and the Muslims because followers of this religion were not permitted to drink. Okay, end of story. He rejected German Catholicism because no glory existed in their temples. And he rejected Judaism because the Jews were condemned to wander the earth. However, when his emissaries returned from Constantinople, the city which was founded by the Holy Roman Emperor Constantine, was the political and cultural center of Europe during Vladimir's time, they reported the beauty of the St. Sophia Cathedral, or Hagia Sophia. The interior of the cathedral made such an impression upon them that they did not know whether they were in heaven or earth. "We only know," they said, "that God dwells there among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations, for we cannot forget that beauty." So beauty makes its conquests, and in the history of religion and its spread, it has often been crucial. It was indeed crucial in the Russian adoption of Christianity. It gave them a beautiful image of that cosmos that they instinctively had been taught to love. Prince Vladimir was baptized and decreed henceforth the Kievan land would adopt Christianity in its Eastern or Greek form. It's said, you know, as many a monarch, they simply immediately required all of the citizenry to change their religion. Nonetheless, we don't have much evidence of there being any resistance. In the next 50 years, a visitor reports that nearly 400 churches have been built in Kiev. So a terrific adoption. Russians quickly adopted Byzantine religion, humanized it, made it their own, humanized the formality of Byzantine religion, and brought to their new church ancient Slavic traditions of community and brotherly love. The pagan Slavs, it was said, were so peaceful that they had no god of war. And two of the earliest figures of veneration in Russian Christianity are two of the sons of Vladimir, Prince Vladimir, and their Boris and Gleb. Patron saints of Russia, popular heroes, because they symbolized voluntary acceptance of suffering and even death with peaceful non-resistance. According to legend, their elder brother seized control of their principalities after Vladimir's death, and they offered no resistance to that brother. They peacefully refused to resist him, and eventually he murdered them both. Through this, they became heroes, culture heroes. So this was an early sign of the kind of extremes to which Russians adopted Christianity and made it their own. Through it, Kiev became a flourishing city, perhaps the most opulent city in Europe in its time. We have to remember in the 10th century, 10th and 11th centuries. Now, how are we doing on time here? Running time. Scott, you wanted to say some things.
No, why don't you continue? I'll have my chance next time.
Well, I want to go on and just get us to Russian Christianity and some ideas about it, and then I'll sit and be quiet. But some contrast we could make if we had a clear whiteboard between Western and Eastern Christianity. Some of you may be quite familiar with Eastern Christianity and with the contrasts here, but to summarize, one list given by Timothy Ware in the Orthodox Church is that of, and we're talking about Christianity here, grace versus law, deification versus redemption, theosis is a term for Greek term for deification, of Christ as victor versus Christ as victim, and of course of patrology, the writings of the church fathers versus scholasticism, the later reasoning based on Greek philosophy, conciliarity, the doctrines of Christianity and the firm structure of Christianity based on the seven councils that were the first seven councils of the church, versus the filioque as an idea that, this was the ultimate cause of the split between Eastern and Western church, whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from both persons both other persons of the Trinity or proceeds directly from the Father. So it's and the Son, filioque means and the Son. And papal authority. And what could be called Byzantine stability versus West's continued experience of barbarian invasions. So there's a certain paradox here in the structurelessness of Russian consciousness. We find a certain kind of democracy. Right? There's no distinction made between different members of that community as a whole, without the clear hierarchy that the West always came back to and relied on, with the Pope at the top of it. You have a series of different communities, all of which are roughly equal, all of which are in a loose way because agreeing not to conflict, simply going in their own ways, and you have the councils as a loose guide to Christianity, and then you have the monasteries as well, which rather than any religious orders, there are no religious orders in Eastern Christianity. So anytime one is monastic, we're all participating in the same Christianity. So that lack of differentiation makes for a more stable, a more unchanging, and in a sense a more democratic view. If we think of democracy not in the American way as the right of every man to vote, one man, one vote, as the way of expressing your individuality, but in the way of being the same as everyone else, and being uninhibited in that way. So we talked about some of the notions that characterized Eastern Christianity, including the notion of the Mother of God, right? The church's infallibility, being something in the whole church and not in the Pope alone. And I think very important, the notion of incarnation, the incarnation of Christ. That is something not considered primarily as an atonement for our sins, as the Western Church emphasizes, but rather a notion of transformation, of a call to a new humanity for which Christ is the model of a transfigured humanity. And so the emphasis is more on the resurrection than on the crucifixion in Eastern Christianity. Man will be saved, it is claimed, because the God-man is here among us, not because of a thing that he did, a contract that he lived out. Right? To redeem, we know, means the same word to mean to buy. So, and it's often said that Christ bought us with his death. But that contract notion is much too legalistic and structured for the Eastern view. Finally, the four last things, notably different in Eastern Christianity. There is no concept of purgatory. The souls of the dead are in an intermediate state of consciousness. They cannot help themselves. They must be prayed for. The prayers of the faithful can cleanse them. So there's a good deal of similarity here, but there's without, again, a designated place and a designated structure for it. There is the belief in Eastern Christianity that unless then there is final impenitence in the soul, all will be saved.
What?
Unless there is final impenitence in the soul, right, all of them will be saved. All of us will be saved. It's a more positive view, perhaps you might say. So a lot of this does, again, show up in the beliefs of in the background for the novels that we're continuing to that we're going to be looking at here. All right.
Should we ask for
Let's do. So questions, comments. I've covered a lot of ground. Less history than I wanted to. Perhaps a little more myth than I wanted to, but. I think the background is important. We've got to get our way. We've got to move our way slowly toward modernity, and we'll talk more about that next time. Questions about the Russian culture in general? Yes.
I don't see how you're phrasing up "all be saved unless they are finally impenitent" is any different than the Roman Catholic understanding that
We're talking about the same religion here. The difference is one of emphasis.
Okay. So it's the emphasis.
Whereas the emphasis is often harsh in Western Christianity.
Right. Okay.
It's less so in Eastern. And there's that kind of a general notion of an upward movement that Christ initiated for the human race and for all creation. Yes.
Did you trace the Pious Tsar and the saintly prince back to Mother Earth?
Right. We're looking at in a sense almost archetypal female and male figures here. The rote meaning procreator or progenitor, the father figure, as the Holy Father. There's also the notion that the father that the two then give birth to the son and the daughter, and the son is the prince. The hero, the prince as hero, the prince as one who is also fated toward death. A number of these associations come out in that pairing of the Holy Father and the Holy Mother, Mother Earth, and are developed as well in the folk tales of Russia, which I haven't had time to visit for you. And in fact, which might just distract us from going where we need to go. But the folk tales often have these figures of the family that and is pronouncedly structured in this way: the prince as son and the holy daughter as well. Yes.
So the Rizal nature of Russia precedes their Orthodox Christianity and shapes it. So does it come from their physical geography, or what's the cause of that?
Geography certainly has a lot to do with it. Russia's removal from closeness to the West and from really any other source makes them, I think, look upon themselves, turn in upon themselves. I don't know. I don't want to go into geographical determinism here because I think it's kind of boggy ground, you know. but at the same time, I want to say, well, of course, geography has something to do with it, right? Because we are all geographical beings. That's pretty vague. Sorry. Yes, Arlen.
Just wondering, how much influence did the Vikings have on, or did they have any kind of influence on the Russian myths, mm-hmm. or just kind of a passing?
One of the things is the social organization. So the that notion of the people as a whole, as a unity, also we see in the Viking people organization. We're familiar with that in studying Old English as the comitatus, right, that clan organized together. So some of that social organization we can see as similar from that. Was there other aspects?
Yeah, and of course the name Rus is a Viking name. Mm-hmm. So
it's the ancient name of Russia.
Mm-hmm. And they were... you have to think that one of the contributions of the Vikings was the bringing together these vast expanses of territory, speaking of geography, which always characterized Russia. Russia has always been a largely ethnically mixed population. And the Rus, the original Vikings, went all the way down to Constantinople from Scandinavia and carried on trading. And so this doubtless accounts for some of the ways in which Russia became more and more aware of the fact of Byzantine Christianity and the brilliance of Byzantine culture at the same time. So I would say that too must have had a very, very important influence on the Russian character ultimately. It's far-flung, it brings together a startlingly wide variety of ethnic groups, and of course with the Tartars and the Mongols we get a domination that lasts for a couple of centuries and that brings in certain institutions and that didn't exist before. I guess the most prominent is serfdom.
Oh, yes.
But in addition to that, there was, I think the Mongols and the Tartars explain a lot about this funny bipolarity of the Russian soul. On the one hand, this domination, and on the other, a kind of willingness to be seen as victims, but to glory in it in a very different way. So as you go through quite a long period of history, you begin to realize that this is a very complex culture, and it's a culture that continues to be shaped by some of the forces that were there from the very beginning.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes things almost happen as a kind of fulfillment of some of their beliefs, like oppression by the Mongols.
Yeah.
Kiev was this flourishing city and then crushed by a Mongolian invasion, and the Russians remained under them for several hundred years.
It wasn't until they moved their capital to Moscow.
To Moscow, right.
That they reestablished themselves.
Yes?
Well, as we talk about, you know, different invasions and migrations that affected these Russian myths, we're talking about such a huge amount of land, and I'm thinking that the Vikings would have come from the west and the Mongols from the east. How did such oneness, if you were to call it that, develop over such an incredibly huge amount of land where people are coming from almost opposite sides of the seaboard? And it's not like they had internet or anything to put it all together.
Well, it didn't happen immediately.
Okay.
So this is the consequence of centuries and centuries of colonization, conquest, spreading. But if I had to name one force in it, it would surely be Christianity that accounts for it all. It comes as a little bit of a shock to realize that Russian literature is almost exclusively religious well up into the 17th century. There is nothing in Russian history and culture and literature to correspond with the Renaissance in the West. So the first book published in Russia and in Russian was in the mid-16th century. And that didn't go over too well, and they didn't do another one for about 100 years. That was the beginning of the 17th century. So on the one hand, you see there's this Third Rome mentality. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's this amazing sense of being backward in relation to the West. And the pivotal century, then we'll talk about this next time, is the 18th century. And it's in the 18th century then that this real tension begins to develop in a spectacular way, but we'll save that for later.
Great. Mm-hmm.
And where did that Viking word come from? What did that mean originally?
It was a tribe.
It was a tribe of people that they conquered?
Yeah, it's a tribe in the sense that the Swedes were originally a small tribe, and the Beowulf's people, the Yats, who are related to Goth, right, because the Goths started way up there, went way east, and swung way around to North Africa even, and then up through Spain, and so on. They split into two groups, the Ostrogoths in the east and Visigoths in the west. So this is all going on, too. There's a tremendous movement of the Germanic peoples.
Thank you.
I am fascinated that this guy, Vladimir of Kiev, sent out envoys to choose a religion. When has that ever happened before?
Quite a bit. Well, it happened in England.
Mm-hmm. There's also a similar story with Japan.
Yeah.
In that the Chinese emissaries, actually Korean emissaries, brought in a great procession of Buddhist art and sculpture, the art, and it so fascinated the early Japanese that they said, well, certainly a worldview this beautiful we must adopt. You know? So Japanese Buddhism from the earliest point before Zen was ornate and full of ceremony and ritual and so forth, all because it was, again, that notion of the impressiveness of its beauty was what won the day for Buddhism.
Yeah. Whereas in the case of the Anglo-Saxons, they had a very dark and pessimistic religion, and the Christian envoys had a much cheerier outlook.
And thereby goes the English tale of the adoption of Christianity. And there was another one, the darn it, I can't remember which people we're talking about, but it was a recent kind of magical realist novel in which the novelist had two different editions of his novel. One was a male ending and one was a female ending.
Yeah.
And but it was it really was based on history, and these particular people, they were also an Eastern, a West Asian people, had sent out emissaries and decided to choose. Well, I mean, it's tempting. If you're in Western Asia, you've got Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and in fact some other religions to choose from. If you're suddenly set upon with a great deal of wealth, then you say, well, let's look about and choose the best. Shall I get a Cadillac or a Lexus? You know, and so forth. You know. So it does happen from time to time.
Shopping for salvation.
So all of this then was this great flourishing culture that then was crushed and by the Mongol invasion, and gave a whole new character then to Russian experience. Russia looked at times to the West to be aided to throw off this yoke of their domination, and they were not, it was never helped. So as one historian wrote, out of the whole experience, Russia learned to fear the East and distrust the West. And we think that's still true today. Yes,
I was going to ask, so I guess for their, the Russian, literary communities must have almost been entirely dependent on the West for their forms, because do they have an epic, or do they have, they must have had, bodies of, they must have had poetry, but do they have to automatically draw on the West for their
No. And we'll hear more about that next time.
Yeah.
I think Scott will.
Well,
the
predominant literary form for hundreds of centuries was the saint's life. But yes, there. We'll talk next time a bit about the lay of the host of Eger, which was not discovered really until the late 18th century. And there's been, it's been a controversial work in some respects, in that some scholars don't think it's genuine, but I think the consensus now is that it must be genuine, that it couldn't have been a forgery, simply because of certain characteristics in the language and some other aspects of it. But.
And then there are the Bellini, the heroic tales, often involving direct stories of resistance to the Mongols and so forth. So, yeah, a lot of those things are quite indigenous forms that spring up. But the novel is a Western form, there's no question about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in our next class, we'll talk some about the literary background of Russia. We'll talk about the history of the Moscow Empire up to Peter the Great, and then spend a special attention on the reforms of Peter the Great, and the whole complex of modernity into which he plunged Russia as early as the early 18th century. It's a remarkable story, and it's one that I think is exemplary for stories of modernization throughout the world. So we want to pay a special attention to it next time. Meanwhile, be reading some novels.